You're listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. Interesting conversations about innovation, economics, culture, and history for the independent thinkers and curious minds. I'm your host, Alex Wolf.
Alrighty, so this week we're talking about three ways the attention economy has ruined the meaning of life. So I want to say the attention economy is my favorite economy to talk about, but I wish I didn't have to talk about it. I think the reason why I like to talk about it is because I see it as the biggest threat right now to our, let's say, meaning of life, overall well-being as a society. And if you don't know, I produced a mini documentary called Attention for Sale back in 2018. And you know, the attention economy is kind of why I sold my company and decided to devote my time to tech philosophy, because I was just, again, very sensitive to how threatening it is to the meaning of life. And when I say meaning of life, what I mean is the worthwhileness of living, the worthiness of living, because I'm a big advocate, obviously, in this idea that I don't think life should be perfect or positive all the time. I just think it should be worth it. And if you look at the data, the very concerning data, more and more each year we are finding people who find life not to be worth it. They are either thinking about, you know, suicide, or they are committing suicide, unfortunately, harmful behaviors to themselves, and just overall depression, just people who just hate it here. And I think a big reason why people hate it here, I think the reason is bad, not thought out tech philosophy. And I think that the attention economy, the scale that it has become, is a direct correlative to this issue. So yeah, when I talk about ruining the meaning of life, I think the attention economy has ruined a sense of worthiness for a lot of people. And that can mean the worthiness of life, but it could also mean like the worthiness of like pursuing your dreams, or the worthiness of you, trying out for this career. It, in a lot of ways and on a lot of different levels, kind of knocks the wind out of the point of things, because as someone who airs to be a little bit more on like the intellectual wordy side, I saw how the attention economy created a very high-risk environment for my type of content. And when I say high-risk, that's not the best term. More just like overall less receptivity, because the media climate we're in right now is very media rich, which we're going to be talking about, which means that it uses highly absorbent types of media that is consumed and judged and comprehended within milliseconds. And when we're reasoning things, and when we're using words and literature, those types of media take a longer time to digest. And I have some material on that as well, I think in my first episode of the podcast. So anyway, what is the attention economy? Let's just break down the fundamentals. The attention economy is the trade of your attention for goods and services instead of your money. Usually in economies, you know, you're trading something. And I talked about a few episodes back the difference between money and wealth, and how money is supposed to be this medium of exchange that's representative of the wealth. And how once you stop trading with money, I mean, money is really practical, because you can make a lot of it, like it's infinite. That was one of the points. But your attention and trading your attention Well, we know very clearly that our attention is not infinite. In fact, from a philosophical perspective, your attention is probably the most finite and scarce and sacred thing you have. So it's just really interesting how we have, you know, really dove headfirst into an economy where we are trading our attention, and most of us did not deliberately sign up for it. We have gotten here by a way of our physiology being exploited, which is what the Attention for Sale documentary is about. You know, just going into literally this relationship between our physiology and our technology. And I think that when we talk about the toxicity of like Facebook and gamification and all of those things, we usually talk about it from a psychological perspective, like how it, you know, kind of F's with our brains and what we think. But I think it's equally as important to be sensitive to the physiological impact it has, because that's how I think it really gravitated towards the scale. I think that's what gave the attention economy the robustness that it now has, is that as a human being who has these sensitive receptors and these, your eyes being attracted to movement and screens having this really, really rich field of movement compared to everything else that's not a screen, that made it really susceptible for, again, our physiology. I think that is very important. And I think when we're talking about tech philosophy, physiology needs to be brought into that conversation more, because when we make it about just psychology, then I think we get too wrapped up in like, oh, you know, creepy tech guys don't care about our feelings, and, you know, deep down we're also psychologically warped. And, you know, there's truth, I think, to both of those things. But again, that and that alone does not give enough depth to what I think the real culprit of how we got here is. So let's talk about the pros of the attention economy, because I think there are absolutely pros. I think, again, the reason why it got so big is because the pros are so good. And the biggest pro is that you get lots of entertainment without having to spend your money. It used to be that people would have to spend money on CDs or spend money on movies, you know, one movie, right? Not necessarily how the mainstream relationship is to a movie now. And these things were affordable for the most part. Like, people could afford their access to entertainment, especially as, you know, technology advanced and camera technology advanced and all those things, and TV technology. But the internet's attention economy made it so that you really didn't have to spend any money. And for many of us who use the internet first, who were millennials, we were actually not paying the bill, like the one bill that it takes, which is the internet bill. And so our relationship with media started off as a free relationship, whereas our parents and our grandparents, you know, would spend a few bucks. And also the range of media they had was very limited, obviously, compared to what we have. Not only do we have free media, we have an abundant, I mean, unimaginable amount compared relative to what was before. So that's the big pro. The big pro is like, you get to be really entertained. You don't really have to worry about boredom in a culture that uses attention economy. You don't have to, you know, figure out how to entertain yourself with a board game or, you know, whatever people were doing before for entertainment. You know how our grandparents kind of joke about, you know, playing with one ball or one doll or whatever their sad story is about entertainment, where we can, I mean, we're oozing it. We are, there's an overcapacity. There's too many tabs open. There's too many things to watch. We are overwhelmed with the options. It's very much the opposite. So that's the pro, okay? Let's just lay that out. It's worth talking about. But the cons are obviously what get my attention and I think our attention. And so the three cons that I have here for living in a mostly an attention economy means that A, you end up getting a shorter attention span as a result of being immersed in a wide-scale attention economy. And the reason of that is because of the competition. Once you have companies who have the scale that they have competing for your attention, your ability to focus gets shorter and shorter and shorter. And this is what we've measured and this is what we've seen year over year. The attention span is not growing in this country or around the world. The attention span is getting shorter, and that's because there's even more entertaining things to watch. You know, every 3 seconds, there's something else that can get your attention. There's somewhere else for your eyes to jump. And it's just this feast of entertainment. And so again, one of the cons is you get a shorter attention span. Now, why is a shorter attention span a con? Well, it moves to con number three, reason is threatened. Reason. So the ability to make a rational decision or a rational thought, that becomes threatened because what happens is because attention economies thrive on rich media, meaning easy to absorb media, meaning images and videos, right? Because the attention economy is running on that, images and all types of visual rich media really don't need you to reason as much as slower forms, less rich types of media do. Because the visual types of media, your brain kind of, instead of reasoning, what it does is it has like an emotional response. So it's not that you're not thinking, but what's happening is you're, again, you have an emotional response to whatever image pops up. So if it's just a flash of an image of like Meg the Stallion, you're going to feel an emotion that would take longer to happen if you saw the word Megan the Stallion, right? Unless the word is in an iconographic way, meaning like it is iconic, so the image almost performs as a picture because you're used to seeing it in a certain font or color or whatever. So because there's all this rich media, you don't have time. Not only do you not have time, but you don't really have an attention span either to reason what you are looking at, because you will tend to have that emotional reaction will overpower the rational mind. Now, rationality is cool. I don't think it's, you know, the number one most important thing in life, but I do think that we need rationality in effective societies because they help us make decisions that are not as emotional. And if there's one word I would give 2020 and, you know, the past 4 or 5 years, it's highly, highly emotional and highly, highly irrational. And I think that's because obviously of the rich media and the way it is distributed in an attention economy. Okay, so the third con is that you live in an environment where you are bombarded with lots of that visual rich media about things that you don't care about or might not want to see. So because the attention economy is at this scale, say you are a mom and you don't want your, you know, 7-year-old son to see graphic images of, you know, something sexual or something like that. And let's say, you know, the scale for that has changed a lot, but let's say like you don't want your son to see like, you know, images of women in, you know, bikinis or something like that. Very common scenario. Before images and rich media kind of took over at this scale, that was pretty easy to do. You know, the chances of a 7-year-old boy seeing those things were, you know, as far as he was concerned, a lottery, right? To see an image or to see it on, you know, even in a magazine, which is somewhat private, but I mean, you can go to Times Square or whatever, you're on the highway, billboards, which I'll get into because I think billboards are fascinating. And it's just there, right? Like, let's take the phones out of the equation. Just the fact that we live in an environment where we've turned surfaces into image windows, right? So like a wall is not a wall in an attention economy. A wall is a surface that can have an image on it. And we know that because of our human anatomy and our physiology, the woman's figure and her body is literally by nature attractive to most of the population. And so people use that figure to take advantage of our physiology and get people to look because they have something to sell. Now, trying to avoid that 7-year-old seeing that now is almost impossible if you ask around and if you talk to parents. It is extremely difficult. And that is the third con of living in an attention economy. That's an example of that third con. I mean, there's all different types of examples of what it feels like to not give consent to being exposed to images. Images are very influential. And again, they spark up a lot of emotions. That's why, you know, we have little warnings like, oh, you know, this may contain graphic images and stuff like that. But for the most part, you don't really have a choice about what images you see out there, like outside. And then when it comes to your screen time, it gets a little stickier because you have a little bit more control. But again, because so many of our mainstream social media apps take advantage of our physiology, you might not be deliberately giving consent to be exposed to like an explore page or something like that. But because of the way it has attracted and conditioned your physiology, you just end up there. It's almost like it's kind of like setting up a trap for an ant, right? It's like, you know, you put a little sugar on the floor and because the ant is attracted to sugar, it goes to the thing. And you might trap the ant and the ant's like, hey, yo, what the hell? Like, you know, I don't want to be trapped. Like, I didn't consent to this trapping. I just wanted the sugar. But that's the dangerous dance, is like, when your physiology is exploited, you don't really know until you're in it. Because again, it's just like the ant is using that antenna to kind of like, oh, where's the sugar? Your eyes are constantly looking for stimuli. And so it's that very similar thing. So, living in New York, surfaces are ads, right? I mean, the train, the idea of being on a train with no ads is weird, right? Ads are so much a part of our lives that you don't really know they're ads. Like, you know, thinking about television and how commercial breaks feel weird if you're not used to the medium having commercial breaks. But once they're normalized, they're normalized. And you're just like, okay, yes, I live in this world and I will be exposed to lots of ads all of the time because people need to sell things and people need to exchange their goods and services so that we can all live, right? I mean, that's the fundamental idea. But when it gets to be an issue when it is at a scale that not only at a scale, but again, what is being traded is not money, right? You're watching the show and you don't realize that watching the show, you're trading your attention, and that is acting as a variable in a business model that has nothing to do with you, right? That show and those advertisers have a relationship. They're doing the business. You are providing an asset for that transaction that is not your money. And again, that's where things get sticky because attention is very valuable, right? Very clear. Okay. So let's talk about, so those are the pros and cons, I think, you know, the general ones. I'm sure there's other ones that we could point out, but those are the big ones I think that stick out. Now I wanted to talk about the pros and cons of spending your money instead of spending your time. So the pros of spending your money is you get products and services that add value and meaning to your life. So let's say that you really wanted a certain conditioner for your hair. Someone will be motivated to make that conditioner for your hair, and in exchange for that conditioner, they will want money. And they can use that money and buy a shampoo they want, right? So money is cool because, money is cool because, you know, you get to use it to just buy wealth. You get to use it to buy anything, really. We know it's not everything, but you know what I mean? Things that add value. Something that clearly is adding value, and it doesn't necessarily have to be entertainment. It could be a variety of things, right? Whatever the last thing you spent your money on. The other pro of spending money is that sometimes, I'm reading too fast. The other pro of spending your money is that it can be like traded. So like your attention, once you give it away, it can be replaced. That's what I'm saying. Money can be replaced. Your attention can't. So I can, you know, give you $5. You give me the conditioner. And then again, you take that $5 and then you buy a shampoo. And then that person who gave you the shampoo buys a comb. You know, obviously my mind is in hair right now, but you can't really do that with attention. Like I can watch your show and then you can't take my attention and add that attention to your attention. You can do other things. If I watch your show, you can use that. And if it's accumulated, you can use that as data to maybe try to get some money. But it's not the same thing. That's clear. So those are the pros of spending your money. And I find that to be way more ethical than spending attention. I think, you know, as someone who's in media and content creation, I obviously value your attention, but I only want it if you think it's worth your attention, right? Whereas the ethics of most of our social media, they don't really care. You know, you don't get a sense that they're after you feeling like, wow, this was a really great use of my time, right? No one's really walking away from social media saying that. Most people are like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? Where is all my attention going? Like, I'm putting too much attention into this, right? And that's the beauty of media for me, is that I love media. My whole business is about how do we make people have the best, how do we make people feel like this is the best, this is one of the best ways to spend your attention. That is my goal. Whereas when we're focusing on these big scale, you know, social media accounts or social media platforms that harvest and kind of like farm attention, that is not the question. The question is not how do we make this the best use of these people's time, but just how do we get them to spend their time, okay, on here. Now, the cons of spending money, we all know the cons. The cons usually might be that, you know, you have to spend money when you don't feel like it, or maybe you feel, you know, you can't afford it, or you don't want to spend your money. That's the con. We've all had that feeling. I think millennials, you know, it's like, oh, I want to watch this movie. Oh, it's not on Netflix. Oh, it's not on Hulu. Well, I ain't watching it because, you know, Amazon will sell it to you for like 10 bucks. But again, because so many of us began our relationship with media as this mostly free, and if not free, very cheap for a lot of access, because Netflix isn't free, but for a small fee, you get access to like a humongous library. But the idea of buying one-on-one media is still kind of alien for a lot of us. And so I think a lot of us don't even think that it's accessible. Like, it's like, oh, I have to pay for money for it. Nope, not going to watch it. Like, we don't think about how on the other side of that transaction is the entertainment you actually want to spend your attention on. And it's funny because I've noticed a shift in the past few years where I actually love buying movies now on Amazon. I have no problem spending, you know, 10 to, like, I think honestly, like, you can rent two for like $2 or $3. I really have no problem because I know it's going to be worth my attention, right? I know after, I'm like, here, all you want is money, like, boom. Because if I'm not doing that, then you kind of have to just sift through the cesspool of the quote unquote free media. And it's funny because we call it free, but if you notice the language I'm using, I'm saying that I'm not necessarily saying it's a free media. I'm saying we didn't have to spend our money, which is true. You don't have to spend your money, but just because you're not spending your money doesn't mean it's free, right? It is coming at a cost, perhaps way more valuable than money could ever be. And that is, you know, that is the con, right? That it is coming at the cost of society slowly collapsing in front of our eyes. Okay, so next, I wanted to, after I laid down those pros and cons, I kind of wanted to just backtrack and talk about how did we get here? Like, what the hell? Like, whose idea was this? And so I want to backtrack to, well, it starts with the camera. It starts with this pesky little crazy little invention called the camera. And the story of the camera is so fascinating. But before we go into that, you know, what's important to understand is that an attention economy cannot run at a scale that threatens the meaning of life unless it has rich reproductive media. Okay? Rich reproductive media, which means that it is a rich reproduction of reality. So to put that in tangible terms, before cameras, people were using painters and paintings for photorealistic images of people and places and stuff like that. And so you couldn't really get a reproduction of reality. You couldn't really get, again, that reproduction of reality, that reproductive media, unless you were super rich and you could afford to pay a painter to make you a portrait of someone. And Alan Watts talks about how I think one of the kings of England hired, what they would do when they would decide who they would marry is they would send the painter to go take a painting and then come back with the painting, and then they would kind of decide, okay, are they attractive enough to get married to? Which is funny because it's very similar, right? We still use photos for that today. Obviously, it's way quicker. But yeah, like, that's how people were using paintings for reproductive reality of, like, okay, I can't see this thing, but this person can paint it and I can see it. Then we had people who were like, how can we make this more scientific? How can we reproduce an image without, you know, relying entirely on human skill and creativity, but on science, on engineering? And so little by little, the photo got better and more clear. And that was now, I mean, the photo changed everything, and not just the photo, but as cameras and film got cheaper, images were starting to, for lack of a better word, litter the world, right? It was a miracle to see an image, you know, in the, let's say, like, late 1800s, like, you know, just like being a regular average Joe or having your own picture. Like, that was, if you looked at your home or if you looked outside, there weren't just images all around, and if they were drawn, right? But photorealistic actual photos were not all over the place And so we have to, I think it's so important to be sensitive to that, because I'm like, that was a very different, like, that makes a difference in how you think and how you, you know, kind of envision yourself as well. And so things got even crazier because the images were now, you know, going to be used in circulatory news media, aka the newspaper. And it changed the whole nature of the newspaper because it was easier to sell things with images. It was easier to have stories. And, you know, there are certain religions that are wary of images, especially like images of God, and how like you shouldn't really draw or have an image of God because it'll affect how you see God, right? Like literally. And I think that is interesting when we think about how images affect how we see ourselves and how we see people, whether they be classes of people, races of people, ages of people. Images start to represent and form perceptions in a different detail that, you know, words didn't have the capacity to do. And so the circulation of newspapers and news with these images ultimately kind of reimagined what fame is, because fame before images were more legendy in the sense that you had to use someone else's description of the person to get an idea or an image of who they were talking about, you know. If they were talking about like a bounty hunter, or just the legends that people would have, and what fame was before images were more about like, you know, like, again, like legends of like, oh, apparently there's a guy who does this, and if you ever see this, that's how you know, the guy has been here or whoever. But images let you see people. And it kind of, I think it turned, I mean, it's what created celebrity, right? Because before that, you were an idea, right? You could be famous, but you were perceived as an idea. But images made you a celebrity. You now could identify physically how someone looked and how that influence changed you. or maybe your adoration to the person. You know, imagine trying to explain Marilyn Monroe, right? And that would happen. Like, people would be like, oh, the most beautiful woman in the world, blah, blah, blah. People would use their words, but, you know, nothing can really make you see an image as much as a freaking image. So that is a really big pivotal point in one of the, like, in the development of the attention economy, is this whole idea of celebrity and fame. And now we can start to develop relationships on a mass scale with an image of someone. And obviously, you know, there's all these other things happening at this time. Movies are becoming a thing. So not only are we getting static images, but we're getting moving ones, which are more lifelike, and an even richer reproductive type of media. It looks even more like reality than a static image. And then, you know, Alan Watts talks about this, and he basically says how, like, we were fixated on how can we make media more and more lifelike? Like, oh, yeah, this, from paintings to a photo, this photo looks really realistic, but it needs color. So then they added color. And then it's like, well, you know, the personality of someone is more in how they move. So they made the movies, right? And then the movies were silent. They're like, well, what really makes something feel lifelike is how they talk and their voice. And then they made the talkies. Like, literally, this is really how shit went down, because that particular type of tech philosophy of believing that technology should be a reproduction of reality just made more media that was realer and realer and more lifelike. And that's, you know, a testament to where we are now with virtual reality and video games and all these things. They are really trying to reproduce your what you're seeing in front of you right now, which is your field of behavior, your reality. So once the celebrity was invented, it it created a whole new dimension of commerce because it quantified attention to sell things, especially tied to a certain figure or image or whatever. It made it really easy to, you know, say, well, if Babe Ruth, you know, eats this, then everyone has an understanding of how Babe Ruth looks. And it's just easier to sell things when people can envision things, and especially when they can envision people they look up to engaging with that thing. So it just changed everything. And that was all before the internet. I think the last thing before I go into the internet, though, is just television, right? So I talked a lot about newspapers and stuff, but really things got, the attention economy really got the legs when we had, when we moved from like radio news and stuff to television, because you used to have to leave your house to see a movie. And someone was like, why do we have to leave the house? We should be able to reproduce rich media right here, boom, in the living room. And the early stories of television are so interesting because they didn't know what the hell to put on there. They didn't really know what to make shows about. Most of the early shows were cameras on people who had radio experience. And so it would usually just be like a camera on like a talking head with papers in front of them as they're speaking. And it took a while before people were like, yo, let's get fancy. Like, we need dancers, we need entertainment, we need jugglers and dogs, and, you know, we need plot, we need theater on here, or, you know, a narrative, I should say. And so it took a while for it to kind of get these legs. And it kind of reminds me of the internet, right? Where it's like, at first people were just so not acquainted with the nature of the internet that it really took a while before people were like, okay, this is what we can use this for. And radio had taught, had been, radio and newspaper and magazine had kind of showed American entrepreneurs how you can use the quantitative collection of attention to sell advertisements. And television obviously took that to a whole nother level, because, you know, you have your early era television, which is like the 50s and 60s, but after cable television came, you really had this expansion of different channels. You know, you went from having maybe like, I don't even know, I'd have to ask an older person, but I'm guessing they had like maybe 20 to 50 channels. But I still remember as a kid, like 75 channels was a lot, right? So and now, like, you have, like, thousands, right? And that's just cable. That's not even the internet, which is millions of channels. YouTube has millions of channels, and Spotify has millions of channels. And it's just freaking nuts. But a lot of this, again, was made possible because of this invention of the camera and combination of invention with, you know, distribution inventions, meaning, like, printing presses and the ability, projectors and things to project movies and televisions. But the point is, we were very obsessed with images. We were like, this images shit is cool. And we're going to keep going in that direction. So now we get to the internet. And I actually had a conversation with my father recently, and he was telling me all these really amazing stories about my grandpa and him, and how my dad's first computer had no screen, which is hard for me to understand, but that's how the first electronic computers were, obviously. And he spoke about how this specific computer, he could hook up to the television, and he would use the keyboard functions to, I guess, program it. and be able to like play games and stuff like that, which is super fascinating. This is the 80s. Now, I say that to say that when the internet first came in the game, you know, obviously it took a while to sell what the hell this thing was. I mean, it was really hard to explain. Marketers didn't, you know, you need marketers to explain things. And this was a field where there weren't many marketers. It was mostly tech guys. And this is why I think Steve Jobs had so much success, because Steve Jobs was a marketer, but everybody else was technical people. So if you would ask even like Bill Gates, like, what does this thing do? What are you talking about? Like, why is this such a big deal? It was hard to decipher what value people could get from it. And there was a moment in internet development and commercialization where entrepreneurs kind of had this opportunity to be in the position to shape the culture of the internet. Like, what is this thing going to be about? Are we going to use it for sports? Are we going to use it for recipes? Those were some of the things people used to say, like, oh, well, you can use it for your recipes, which reminds me a lot of how we talk about, you know, Amazon Alexa, gotta say it low. And, you know, are we going to use this for communication? Like, how are we going to make money from this? And it's really fascinating to think about, because we decided to go mostly in this direction of third-party software that would connect people and use ads to fund the network, right? Now, my dad was telling me about the computer mouse and how he was kind of not disappointed, but a little like he felt like the mouse was going to take away from his computer experience, because you have to realize before the mouse, you could only navigate a computer through the keys in the keyboard. And Apple actually introduced the mouse, which is pretty funny. And again, like, the mouse represents a very user-friendly feature, interactive. Once your computer could have its own graphic interface, which means like the screen, but not just the screen, but the visuals of like little folders and a little, you know, start button and stuff like that, where you can, it's click and drag, right? Like, you know how to make a graphic image, you know, 10 years ago, you needed to know Photoshop, versus now you can just go on Canva or whatever and click and drag and get, you know, pretty much the same result. So the mouse literally was like giving non-computer nerd types the ability to click and drag things around, which made it more user-friendly, and then it gave it a higher adoption, which, again, Steve Jobs was thinking, like, I love computers. I see the point of computers. As a marketer, how do I make this a friendly, you know, that was the point of making Lisa say hello, making the computer say hello, and giving it a face and all those things. He was really trying to get us comfortable. And he, people talk about his, you know, iPod success and stuff and his iPhone success, which was monumental. But the only reason why that was so successful is because him and that team were able to strategize just comfort. How do we get people from thinking this is totally weird to understanding what the hell it even is? And so many people, many billionaires and people were made out of just his and his team's ability to get people acquainted and adopt, go from, I don't know what that thing is, I don't want that thing, to, oh, I now identify how this thing can help me. So this was a very interesting time. And AOL, Netscape first, but AOL, I have a little bit more like memory of, was very successful in being one of the people who are like, okay, this is how we want the internet to look, and this is how we want it to feel. AOL providing internet service, you know, they had to be creative about what quote unquote being on the internet, you know, really meant. Because before that, it just, people couldn't decipher, right? And I don't know if you remember, but AOL was kind of stuffed with all those things, the sports and the recipes and obviously communication capabilities, and they really did their best to make it close to a magazine. They were very freaking successful. They got a lot of people to be like, okay, this is interneting. Like, this is what it is supposed to feel like. But what's so interesting is that you had to buy AOL. Like, to get your internet packaged in that pretty way, because you could still technically go on the internet without that third-party software, but it would just look like, you know, it would just look like codes on the screen. It wasn't this, like, pretty magazine thing, and look, your favorite celebrities in the corner, and AOL was the, you know, was one of the pioneers in making this very consumer-friendly, and, but it wasn't an ad business model. I mean, it gets a little tricky because they had deals with Warner, and the way they licensed and distributed content did have some roots in like pre-existing relationships in the media world. But for the most part, you understood that to get this experience, you have to pay, right? Now, the reason why AOL went away, I don't know if you remember, we probably remember, but some of us don't necessarily know the business history, but Bill Gates and Microsoft just Facebooked. This is why that's a topic for another day, but they Facebooked basically, and they stole the feature. And they said, oh yeah, you know, the software that everyone loves that we make, we're just going to put our own freaking browser in there. Done. So that made it very impossible for other internet service providers to, you know, sell, because now the software you were using to operate your computer already had the browser feature built in. So you could explore the internet. That was Internet Explorer. The good old days, Internet Explorer. There was a day, I mean, I remember when Internet Explorer was the shit. Like, today it's funny, but it really, it did what it was meant to do. But once we got to Internet Explorer, this is where the attention economy started to root its feet in the ground, because we had websites and we had Google and Yahoo. And the next thing you know, Google, which started as a company that literally promised they would never sell ads, that was like in their like mission statement in the beginning, suddenly decided to sell ads. And this is where we really see a big turn, because unlike a magazine, you know, we used a magazine interface for a lot of websites, you know, kind of like pictures with text on the bottom, and, you know, this idea of pages. Those are conceptually coming from the analog world, just the idea of folders and pages and those things. But the difference is that the nature of these quote-unquote pages are that they are not just limited to static imagery, and the advertisements are not limited to static, just like being static, in the sense that the ads can change and they can customize. And, you know, depending on your keywords and your interests and what page you're on, in a capacity that even television couldn't do, because the main differences, again, for the internet were that, you know, instead of like 60 pages of a magazine, it could be billions, or instead of a couple channels on the TV, it could be, you know, a bunch more. And another big thing is that instead of this medium not being interactive, like magazines and television that can't really talk back to you, the internet can talk back to you. It can go, you can say something and someone can really say something back. And that is what fucked us all up. I'm just kidding. That is how we scaled to where we are now. Because as technology got better, as platforms started to make space for people who wanted to upload their own media to to communicate with other people, those platforms started to see just how much ads they could sell. And that's where you get, you know, some of the historic booms in the tech world. You know, and it's interesting because you have your grain of people who went the product route, meaning that they decided to keep it a money exchange versus an attention exchange. So you think about, and in my opinion, they did so much better, because the whole controversy about the internet bubble, and if you're not familiar, this was like the late 90s when people, kind of similar to like what we're seeing in the stock market now, where people were just buying kind of crazily because, well, it's not entirely the same, but basically people were buying a lot of .com stocks because they just associated .com with like being rich. So if you bought, you know, pets.com or axgs.com, those were good stocks. No matter what, if it had a .com, it was going to be good. But it's so interesting because it works just like Instagram creators today, where just because a website gets a bunch of clicks, it doesn't mean it has a business infrastructure involved that will support the initial investment. Meaning that, yeah, you can invest in pets.com, but if pets.com doesn't have a way to make money, then you're ass out of luck. All you got is a bunch of users. And so when you look at the Amazons and the eBays and even the PayPals, I have a different amount of respect for those companies, because not only were they able to navigate all the craziness of the dot-com boom, but they really had real business models that you know, provided an infrastructure for what these investments, how these investments could be reaped on. And so, and that's the big difference, is like to this day, eBay doesn't, they're not, you know, they don't need you to be on the website so they can make money from your attention. They want you to buy shit. Amazon, hello, we already know. And then, what was the other one I said? Forget. PayPal, right? PayPal was like, oh, people are buying shit online. Like, let's just take a commission off of each transaction by making it secure, right? Like, those, PayPal doesn't need you to scroll on PayPal for 5 hours a day to make money. they just need you to just buy shit, right? And again, because you're trading your money instead of your attention, whatever you're buying, hopefully if you're, you know, if you know what's good for you, it's going to add value to your life. So we had the internet companies that went that way. And then we had the internet companies that went the ad way. And that's where you really see this volatility. That's where you really, not just the ad way, but the high daily active users way. Well, we have so many people on our platform, Clubhouse, and oh my God, isn't it just crazy? We're worth billions. Oh my God. Look at all this activity. and people would just like, they put their money up here. Take my money. Yes, yes, yes. It's going to work. You know, it can if you have the right business development implemented, but it's not easy. It's not, you can't just snap your fingers and make it happen. So obviously that is, I think the liability with social media is that it depends, up until this point, unfortunately, it depends on ad business models, and it depends on your attention to run as a company. And instead of PayPal, who just says, hey, you want to buy something online, we're going to provide you with an actual service, Facebook just says, we'll entertain you. We'll make you feel things. we got it all. You want to be upset, mad, angry, happy? What do you want? you want to be distracted, you want to compete, yeah, we got that. We will stimulate both sides of your emotional spectrum until you want to kill yourself. We got that. As far as like goods and services, we can take your money if you want to sell ads, though. Yeah. Well, you know, those followers you have, if you really want to reach all of them, you should give us some of your money. And then we'll show your content to all. Because, you know, the way our business is set up, it just doesn't make sense for us to show all of your content to all your followers. It's just not really what we want to do, right? Okay. Okay, I'm reloaded. That is where we are now. Because we thought it was a good idea to have advertisements in the middle of our conversations. Okay, so to wrap this up, I want to end this on the note of how do ads take away from our experience online? Ads at this scale. Let me reiterate. I love ads. I'm an ad girl. I will buy books. I will study ads. Honey, don't get it twisted. I think ads are great because I think good business needs good marketing and good advertising. But my issue is this is not about good business because we are not trading money here. We are trading attention, right? So how do ad models at this scale take away from our experience online? How do they take away from our experience, period, right? We talked about some of the cons earlier, the shorter attention span because everyone's competing for your attention, so it dwindles in the process. The fact that reason and rationality is threatened to, you know, high risk at a high risk rate, and things become, decisions are made more out of emotion because we are using rich visual media to decide things about presidents and people and concepts and things like that. And of course, the other con is that you have kind of no choice but to live in an environment where you have very little control about how many images and what those images are. And not just you, but your family. And so this now, you know, it seems like people are starting to figure this out. And that's why you're seeing this shift into the creator's economy. The creator's economy. You know, I have to make fun of everybody talking about the creator's economy because I was laughed at. That's why. I was laughed at a few years when I went in to a few social media companies that shall remain nameless. And I said, hey, you know, we've got this like largest network in history of people, in the history of people who want to communicate, yet effectively communicating on here is still really difficult. What are you going to do about that? You call yourself social media? Yeah, you're selling ads. You're interrupting the conversations that want to be had up until the point that people will pay to have them, meaning that as a creator and even as an audience member, why is it so hard for creators to talk to their audience? Please let me know. Please let me know. Oh. Why? Did you know that up to more than half of your content, or no, sorry, up to more than half of your audience might not even see what you post on Instagram because it doesn't work with their business model. Okay, so why is this happening? It's because we've become so bamboozled with this attention economy that we've forgotten the lucrative nature of the fucking money economy. You know, the stuff, the medium of exchange that we use, why is it so hard? Please, I'm in 2021. Why is it so hard to communicate to the people who want to hear from you? Make it make sense. What's getting in the way? I don't understand. You have something you want to say. You have a group of people who want to hear it. Yet, it's very difficult to effectively do that on this thing we called social media. The attention economy insists on stuffing ads and algorithms between our conversations. Why? Why does having a conversation on the internet have to be this complicated? they've created such an obstacle that they've ignored the very real money in providing services that help creators get in contact from the people who want to hear from them. Duh. Oh, Zuckerberg. Oh, well, you know, we can't because of this and this and that. And, you know, he's so fearful of, like, not having this much market share on the ad economy, attention economy. Sell something else. If you sell ads, sell them at a scale that is sustainable, not just to your company, but to the world. Okay. You know, this is what people are waking up to, but these, everything I'm saying right now, literally I have copied and pasted from slides I have since 2017. So it's cute that we have now the VCs are waking up. Oh, actually, have you heard of this thing called the creator's economy? Yeah. Apparently, you know, creators are spending money to talk to people who want to hear from them. No shit, Sherlocks. Sorry, I just have to go there because it didn't make sense when I brought it up. I thought I made myself clear, but apparently I didn't. You know what it is? I think, too, people just have to see the money. You know, I say the best time to hop on a trend is before there's any data. They had to see the data. They had to see, oh, actually, oh, creators actually want to, oh, people will actually pay to listen to, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Where have you been? Sorry. So, that is that. Interested to see what you have to say. You know, I think attention economies are not threatening when they are smaller. I think, yeah, a lot of us are reevaluating this whole thing. What are some other things the internet can do? What are some other things the internet can do? Call me when y'all ready to ask that question. Because right now, we think social media has to look like this. We think it has to have like buttons and followers and all this shit. It doesn't have to have that. You know, you can be innovative. You can work with creators and not against them. All right. So anyway, thank you for tuning in. I hope this was interesting. Message me, DM me, say hello on Twitter. You know how this game goes. All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And if you aren't already, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more resources on innovation, economics, and culture, visit alexwolf.co/newsletter and sign up for my email list. Thanks.